Not so coincidentally, all of the bouncers at the bar where we'd been were Army SF. They would surely back me up if it came to that. It didn't. "We thought so," said the MPs, shaking their heads. They went back over to the idiot soldier and started bitching him out for lying and wasting their time. Serves him right for getting into a fight started by his girlfriend. I came back west with a shattered bone. The guys all made fun of me for my weak genes, but the injury wasn't all that funny for me, because the doctors couldn't figure out whether they should operate or not. My finger set a little deeper in my hand, not quite where it should be. In San Diego, one of the doctors took a look and decided they might be able to fix it by pulling it and resetting it in the socket. I told him to give it a go. "You want some painkiller?" he asked. "Nah," I said. They'd done the same thing at the Army hospital back east, and it hadn't really hurt. Maybe Navy doctors pull harder. The next thing I knew, I was lying flat back on a table in the cast room. I'd passed out and pissed myself from the pain. But at least I got away without surgery. And for the record, I've since changed my fighting style to accommodate my weaker hand. Ready to go. I had to wear a cast for a few weeks, but more and more I got into the swing of things. The pace built up and we got ready to ship out. There was only one down note. We had been assigned to a western province in Iraq. From what we had heard, nothing was going on there. We tried to get transferred to Afghanistan, but we couldn't get released by the area commander. That didn't sit too well with us, certainly not with me. If I was going back to war, I wanted to be in the action, not twiddling my broken fingers in the desert. Being a SEAL, you don't want to sit around with your thumb up your ass. You want to get in the action. Still, it felt good to be getting back to war. I'd been burned out when I came home, completely overwhelmed and emotionally drained. But now I felt recharged and ready to go. I was ready to kill some more bad guys. 13. Mortality. Blind. It seemed like every dog in Sadr City was barking. I scanned the darkness through my night vision, tense as we made our way down one of the nastiest streets in Sadr City. We walked past a row of what might have been condos in a normal city. Here they were little better than rat-infested slums. It was past midnight in early April 2008, and against all common sense, but under direct orders, we were walking into the center of an insurgent hellhole. Like a lot of other drab brown buildings on the street, the house we were heading to had a metal grate in front of the door. We lined up to breach it. Just then, someone appeared from behind the grate at the door and said something in Arabic. Our interpreter stepped up and told him to open up. The man inside said he didn't have a key. One of the other SEALs told him to go get it. The man disappeared, running up the stairs somewhere. Shit! Go, I yelled. Break the grate the fuck in! We rushed in and started clearing the house. The two bottom levels were empty. I raced up the stairs to the third floor and moved to the doorway of a room facing the street, leaning my back against the wall as the rest of my guys stacked to follow. As I started to take a step, the whole room blew up. By some miracle, I hadn't been hit, though I sure felt the force of the blast. "Who the fuck just threw a frag?" I yelled. Nobody, and the room itself was empty. Someone had just fired an RPG into the house. Gunfire followed. We regrouped. The Iraqi who'd been inside had clearly escaped to alert the nearby insurgents where we were. Worse, the walls in the house proved pretty flimsy, unable to stand up to the rocket grenades that were being fired at us. If we stayed here, we were going to get fried. "Out of the house, now!" The last of my guys had just cleared out of the building when the street shook with a huge force. The insurgents had set off an IED down the street. The blast was so powerful it knocked a few of us off our feet. Ears ringing, we ran to another building nearby. But as we were fixing to enter it, all hell broke loose. We got gunfire from every direction, including above. A shot flew into my helmet. The night went black, I was blind. It was my first night in Solder City, and it looked like it was going to be my last on Earth. Out West. Until that point, I had spent an uneventful, even boring, fourth deployment in Iraq. Delta Platoon had arrived roughly a month before, traveling out to Al-Qa'im in western Iraq near the Syrian border. Our mission was supposed to involve long-range desert patrols, but we'd spent our time building a base camp with the help of a few Seabees. Not only was there no action to speak of, but the Marines who owned the base were in the process of shutting it down, meaning that we'd have to move out soon after we set it up. I have no idea what the logic was. Morale hit rock bottom when my chief risked his life early one morning. By that I mean he entered my room and shook me awake. "What the hell?" I yelled, jumping up. "Easy," said my chief. "You need to get dressed and come with me."
"I just got to sleep."
"You'll want to come with me. They're putting together a task unit over in Baghdad." A task unit? All right. It was like something out of the movie Groundhog Day, but in a good way. The last time this happened to me, I was in Baghdad, heading west. Now I was west and heading east. Why exactly? I wasn't sure. According to the chief, I had been chosen for the unit partly because I was qualified to be an LPO, but mostly because I was a sniper. They were pulling snipers from all over the country for the operation, though he had no details of what was being planned. He didn't even know whether I was going to a rural or urban environment. Shit, I thought. We're going to Iran. It was an open secret that the Iranians were arming and training insurgents, and in some cases even attacking Western troops themselves. There were rumors that a force was being formed to stop the infiltrators on the border. I was convoyed over to Al-Asad, the big airbase in Al-Anbar province, where our top headshed was located. There I found out we weren't going to the border, but a place much worse, Solder City. Located on the outskirts of Baghdad, Solder City had become even more of a snake pit since the last time I'd been with the Groms a few years before. 2 million Shiites lived there. The rabidly anti-American cleric Muqtada al-Solder, the city had been named for his father, had been steadily building his militia, the Mahdi Army, known in Arabic as the Jaish al-Mahdi. There were other insurgents operating in the area, but the Mahdi Army was by far the biggest and most powerful. With covert help from Iran, the insurgents had gathered arms and started launching mortars and rockets into Baghdad's green zone. The entire place was a viper's nest. Like Fallujah and Ramadi, there were different cliques and varying levels of expertise among the insurgents. The people here were mostly Shiites, whereas my earlier battles in Iraq had been primarily with Sunnis. But otherwise, it was a very familiar hellhole. This was all fine with me. They pulled snipers and JTACs, along with some officers and chiefs, from teams 3 and 8 to create a special task unit. There were about 30 of us all together. In a way, it was an all-star team with some of the best of the guys in the country. And it was very sniper-heavy, because the idea was to implement some of the tactics we'd used in Fallujah, Ramadi, and elsewhere. There was a lot of talent, but because we were drawn from all different units, we needed to spend a bit of time getting used to each other. Small differences in the way East Coast and West Coast teams typically operated could make for a big problem in a firefight. We also had a lot of personnel decisions to make, selecting point men and the like. The Army had decided to create a buffer zone to push the insurgents far enough away that their rockets would reach the green zone. One of the keys to this was erecting a wall in Solder City. Basically, a huge cement fence called a T-wall that would run down a major thoroughfare about a quarter of the way into the slum. Our job was to protect the guys building that wall and take down as many bad guys as possible in the process. The boys building that wall had an insanely dangerous job. A crane would take one of the concrete sections off the back of a flatbed and haul it into place. As it was set down, a private would have to climb up and unhook it. Under fire, generally, and not just pop shots, the insurgents would use any weapon they had,
from AKs to RPGs. Those Army guys had serious balls. A Special Forces unit had already been operating in Solder City, and they gave us some pointers and intel. We took about a week getting things all worked out and figuring out how we were going to skin this cat. Once everything was settled, we were dropped off in an Army FOB, forward operating base. At this point, we were told we were going to foot patrol into Solder City at night. A few of us argued that it didn't make much sense. The place was crawling with people who wanted to kill us, and on foot, we'd be easy targets. But someone thought it would be smart if we walked in during the middle of the night. Sneak in, they told us, and there won't be trouble. So we did. Shot in the back. They were wrong. There I was, shot in the head and blind. Blood streamed down my face. I reached up to my scalp. I was surprised. Not only was my head still there, but it was intact. But I knew I'd been shot. Somehow I realized that my helmet, which hadn't been strapped, had been pushed back. I pulled it forward. Suddenly I could see again. A bullet had struck the helmet, but with incredible luck had ricocheted off my night vision, slamming the helmet backward, but otherwise not harming me. When I pulled it forward, I brought the scope back down in front of my eyes and could see again. I hadn't been rendered blind at all, but in the confusion, I couldn't tell what was going on. A few seconds later, I got hit in the back with a heavy round. The bullet pushed me straight to the ground. Fortunately, the round hit one of the plates in my body armor. Still, it left me dazed. Meanwhile, we were surrounded. We called to each other and organized a retreat to a marketplace we'd passed on the way in. We started laying down fire and moving together. By this time, the blocks around us looked like the worst scenes in Black Hawk Down. It seemed like every insurgent, maybe every occupant, wanted a piece of the idiot Americans who'd foolishly blundered into Solder City. We couldn't get into the building we retreated to. By now, we'd called for QRF, a quick response force, a fancy name for the cavalry. We needed backup and extraction. Help, in capital letters. A group of Army strikers came in. Strikers are heavily armed personnel carriers, and they were firing everything they had. There were plenty of targets. Upward of 100 insurgents lined the roofs on the surrounding streets trying to get us. When they saw the strikers, they changed their aim, trying to take out the Army's big personnel carriers. There, they were overmatched. It started looking like a video game. Guys were falling off the rooftops. "Motherfucker, thank you," I said aloud when the vehicles reached our building. I swear I could hear a cavalry horn somewhere in the background. They dropped their ramps, and we ran inside. "Did you see how many motherfuckers were up there?" said one of the crewmen as the vehicle sped back to the base. "No," I answered. "I was too busy shooting." "They were all over the place." The kid was stoked. "We were dropping them, and that wasn't even half of them. We were just laying it down. We thought y'all were fucking done." That made more than two of us. That night scared the shit out of me. That's when I came to the realization that I'm not superhuman. I can die. All through everything else, there had been points where I thought, I'm going to die. But I never did die. Those thoughts were fleeting. They evaporated. After a while, I started thinking, they can't kill me. They can't kill us. We're fucking undefeatable. I have a guardian angel, and I'm a SEAL, and I'm lucky, and whatever the hell it is, I cannot die. Then, all of a sudden, within 2 minutes, I was nailed twice. Motherfucker, my number is up. Building the wall. We felt happy and grateful to have been rescued. We also felt like total asses. Trying to sneak into Solder City was not going to work, and command should have known that from the start. The bad guys would always know we were there, so we would just have to make the most of it. 2 days after getting our butts kicked out of the city, we came back, this time riding in strikers. We took over a place known as the Banana Factory. This was a building 4 or 5 stories high, filled with fruit lockers and assorted factory gear, most of it wrecked by looters long before we got there. I'm not sure exactly what it had to do with bananas or what the Iraqis might have done there. All I knew at the time was that it was a good place for a sniper hide. Wanting a little more cover than I would have had on the roof, I set up on the top floor. Around 9 o'clock in the morning, I realized the number of civilians walking up and down the street had started to thin. That was always a giveaway. They spotted something, and they knew they didn't want to end up in the line of fire. A few minutes later, with the street now deserted, an Iraqi came out of a partially destroyed building. He was armed with an AK-47. When he reached the street, he ducked down, scouting in the direction of the engineers who were working down the road on the wall, apparently trying to pick one out to target. As soon as I was sure what he was up to, I aimed center mass and fired. He was 40 yards away. He fell dead. An hour later, another guy poked his head out from behind a wall on another part of the street. He glanced in the direction of the T-wall, then pulled back. It may have seemed innocent to someone else, and certainly didn't meet the ROEs, but I knew to watch more carefully. I'd seen insurgents follow this same pattern now for years. They would peek out, glance around, then disappear. I called them peekers. They peeked out to see if anyone was watching. I'm sure they knew they couldn't be shot for glancing around. I knew it too, but I also knew that if I was patient, the guy, or whoever he was spotting for, would most likely reappear. Sure enough, the fella reappeared a few moments later. He had an RPG in his hand. He knelt quickly, bringing it up to aim. I dropped him before he could fire. Then it became a waiting game. The rocket was valuable to him. Sooner or later, I knew someone would be sent to get it. I watched. It seemed like forever. Finally, a figure came down the street and scooped up the grenade launcher. It was a kid, a child. I had a clear view in my scope, but I didn't fire. I wasn't going to kill a kid, innocent or not. I'd have to wait until the savage who put him up to it showed himself on the street. Target rich. I ended up getting 7 insurgents that day, and more the next. We were in a target-rich environment. Because of the way the streets were laid out and the number of insurgents, we were getting close shots. A number were as close as 200 yards. My longest during this time was only about 880. The average was around 400. The city around us was schizophrenic. You'd have ordinary civilians going about their business, selling things, going to market, whatever. And then you'd have guys with guns trying to sneak up on the side streets and attack the soldiers putting up the wall. After we began engaging the insurgents, we would become the targets ourselves. Everyone would know where we were, and the bad guys would come out of their slug holes and try and take us down. It got to the point where I had so many kills that I stepped back to let the other guys have a few. I started giving them the best spots in the buildings we took over. Even so, I had plenty of chances to shoot. One day we took over this house, and after letting my guys choose their places, there were no more windows to fire from. So I took a sledgehammer and broke a hole in the wall. It took me quite a while to get it right. When I finally set up my place, I had about a 300-yard view. Just as I got on my gun, 3 insurgents came out right across the street, 15 yards away. I killed all of them. I rolled over and said to one of the officers who'd come over, "You want a turn?" After a few days, we figured out that the attacks were concentrating when the work crews reached an intersection. It made sense. The insurgents wanted to attack from a place where they could easily run off. We learned to bump up and watch the side streets. Then we started pounding these guys when they showed up. Fallujah was bad. Ramadi was worse. Sadr City was the worst. The overwatches would last 2 or 3 days. We'd leave for a day, recharge, then go back out. It was balls-to-the-wall firefights every time. The insurgents brought more than just their AKs to fight. We were getting rocketed every fight. We responded by calling in air cover, hellfires, and what have you. The surveillance network overhead had been greatly improved over the past several years, and the U.S. wanted to make pretty good use of it when it came to targeting predators and other assets. But in our case, the bastards were right out in the open, extremely easy to spot, and very plentiful. There were claims by the Iraqi government at one point that we were killing civilians. That was pure bullshit. While just about every battle was going down, Army intelligence analysts were intercepting insurgent cell phone communications that were given a blow-by-blow account. "They just killed so-and-so," ran one conversation. "We need more mortarmen and snipers. They killed 15 today." We had only counted 13 down in that battle. I guess we should have taken 2 out of the maybe column and put them in the definite category. Get my gun. As always, there were moments of high anxiety mixed with bizarre events and random comic relief. One day at the end of an op, I hustled back to the Bradley with the rest of the guys. Just as I reached the vehicle, I realized my sniper rifle had been left behind. I'd put it down in one of the rooms, then forgotten to bring it with me when I'd left. Yeah, stupid. I reversed course. LT, one of my officers, was just running up. "Hey, we gotta go back," I said. "My gun's in the house." "Let's do it," said LT, following me. We turned around and raced back to the house. Meanwhile, insurgents were sweeping toward it, so close we could hear them. We cleared the courtyard, sure we would run into them. Fortunately, there was no one there. I grabbed the rifle and we raced back to the Bradleys, about 2 seconds ahead of a grenade attack. The ramp shut and the explosion sounded. "What the hell?" demanded the officer in charge as the vehicle drove off. LT smirked. "I'll explain later," he said. I'm not sure he ever did. Victory. It took about a month to get the barriers up. As the army reached its objective, the insurgents started to give up. It was probably a combination of them realizing the wall was going to be finished whether they liked it or not, and the fact that we had killed so many of the bastards that they couldn't mount much of an attack. Where 30 or 40 insurgents would gather with AKs and RPGs to fire on a single fence crew at the beginning of the op, toward the end, the bad guys were putting together attacks with 2 or 3 men. Gradually, they faded into the slums around us. Muqtada al-Sadr, meanwhile, decided it was time for him to try and negotiate a peace with the Iraqi government. He declared a ceasefire and started talking to the government. Imagine that. Taya. People always told me I didn't really know Chris or what he was doing because he was a SEAL. I remember going to an accountant one time. He said he knew some SEALs and those guys told him no one ever really knew where they went. "My husband's on a training trip," I said. "I know where he is."
"You don't know that."
"Well, yes, I do. I just talked to him."
"But you don't really know what they're doing. They're SEALs." You can never know.
"I know my husband."
"You just can't know. They're trained to lie."
People would say that a lot. It irritated me when it was someone I didn't know well. The people I did know well respected that I might not know every detail, but I knew what I needed to know. In the villages. With things relatively calm in Sadr City, we were given a new area to target. IED makers and other insurgents had set up shop in a series of villages near Baghdad, trying to operate under the radar as they supplied weapons and manpower to fight Americans and the loyal Iraqi forces. The Mahdi army was out there, and the area was a virtual no-go zone for Americans. We had worked with members of 410 Mountain Division during much of the Sadr City battle. They were fighters. They wanted to be in the shit, and they certainly got their wish there. Now, as we bumped out into the villages outside the city, we were happy to have a chance to work with them again. They knew the area. Their snipers were especially good, and having them along improved our effectiveness. Our jobs are the same, but there are a few differences between Army and SEAL snipers. For one thing, Army snipers use spotters, which we don't as a general rule. Their weapon set is a bit smaller than ours. But the bigger difference, at least at first, had to do with tactics and the way they were deployed. Army snipers were more used to going out in 3 or 4-man groups, which meant they couldn't stay out for very long, certainly not all night. The SEAL task unit, on the other hand, moved in heavy and locked down an area, basically looking for a fight and having the enemy provide us with one. It wasn't so much an overwatch anymore as a dare. Here we are. come and get us. And they did, village after village. The insurgents would come and try and kill us. We'd take them down. Typically, we'd spend at least one night and usually a few going in and extracting after sunset. In this area, we ended up going back to the same village a few times, usually taking a different house each time. We'd repeat the process until all the local bad guys were dead, or at least until they understood that attacking us was not very smart. It was surprising how many idiots you had to kill before they finally got that point. Covered with crap. There were lighter moments, but even some of those were shitty. Literally. Our point man, Tommy, was a great guy, but as it turned out, a terrible point in a lot of ways. Or maybe I should say sometimes he was more of a duck than a point man. If there was a puddle between us and the objective, Tommy took us through it. The deeper, the better. He was always having us walk through the worst possible terrain. It got so ridiculous that finally I told him, "One more time, I'm going to whoop your ass and you're fired." On the very next mission, he found a path to a village that he was sure would be dry. I had my doubts. In fact, I pointed them out to him. "Oh, no, no," he insisted. "It's good. It's good." Once we were out in the field, we followed him across some farmland on a narrow path that led to a pipe across a path of mud. I was at the back of the group, one of the last to come across the pipe. As I stepped off, I sunk right through the mud and into crap up to my knee. The mud was actually just a thin crust atop a deep pool of sewage. It stunk even worse than a rack usually stunk. "Tommy," I yelled, "I'm going to whip your ass as soon as we get to the house." We pushed on to the house. I was still in the rear. We cleared the house, and once all the snipers were deployed, I went to find Tommy and give him the thrashing I'd promised. Tommy was already paying for his sins. When I found him downstairs, he was hooked up to an IV and puking his brains out. He had fallen into the muck and was completely covered with shit. He was sick for a day, and he smelled for a week. Every article of clothing he'd been wearing was disposed of, probably by a hazmat unit. Served him right. I spent somewhere between 2 and 3 months in the villages. I had roughly 20 confirmed kills while I was there. The action on any particular op could be fierce. It could also be slow. There was no predicting. Most of the houses we took over belonged to families who at least pretended to be neutral. I'd guess that the majority of them hated the insurgents for causing trouble and would have been even happier than we were to have the bad guys leave. But there were exceptions, and we were plenty frustrated when we couldn't do anything about it. We went into one house and saw police uniforms. We knew instantly that the owner was Mooj. The insurgents were stealing uniforms and using them to disguise themselves in attacks. Of course, he gave us a BS line about having just gotten a job as a part-time police officer, something he'd mysteriously forgotten to mention when we first interrogated him. We called it back to the army, gave them the information, and asked what to do. They had no intelligence on the guy. In the end, they decided the uniforms weren't evidence of anything. We were told to turn him loose, so we did. It gave us something to think about every time we heard of an attack by insurgents dressed as policemen over the next few weeks. Extracted. One night we entered another village and took over a house at the edge of some large open fields, including one used for soccer. We set up without a problem, surveying the village and preparing for any trouble we might face in the morning. The tempo of the ops had slowed quite a bit over the past week or two. It looked as if things were slacking down, at least for us. I started thinking about going back west and rejoining my platoon. I set up in a room on the second floor with LT. We had an army sniper and his spotter in the room next to us, and a bunch of guys on the roof. I'd taken the .338 Lapua with me, figuring that most of my shots would be on the long side since we were on the edge of the village. With the area around us quiet, I started scanning out farther, to the next village, a little more than a mile away. At some point, I saw a one-story house with someone moving on the roof. It was about 2,100 yards away, and even with the 25-power scope, I couldn't make out much more than an outline. I studied the person, but at that point he didn't seem to have a weapon, or at least he wasn't showing it. His back was to me, so I could watch him, but he couldn't see me. I thought he was suspicious, but he wasn't doing anything dangerous, so I let him be. A little while later, an army convoy came down the road beyond the other village, heading in the direction of the cop we had just staged out of. As it got closer, the man on the roof raised a weapon to his shoulder. Now the outline was clear. He had a rocket launcher, and he was aiming it at Americans. RPG. We had no way of calling the convoy directly. To this day, I don't know exactly who they were, except that they were army. But I put my scope on him and fired, hoping to at least scare him off with the shot or maybe warn the convoy. At 2,100 yards plus a little change, it would take a lot of luck to hit him. A lot of luck. Maybe the way I jerked the trigger to the right adjusted for the wind, maybe gravity shifted and put that bullet right where it had to be. Maybe I was just the luckiest son of a bitch in Iraq. Whatever. I watched through the scope as the shot hit the Iraqi, who tumbled over the wall to the ground. "Wow," I muttered. "You dumb lucky fucker," said LT. 2,100 yards. The shot amazes me even now. It was a straight-up luck shot. No way one shot should have gotten him. But it did. It was my longest confirmed kill in Iraq, even longer than that shot in Fallujah. The convoy started reacting, probably unaware of how close they'd come to getting lit up. I went back to scanning for bad guys. As the day went on, we started taking fire from AKs and rocket-propelled grenades. The conflict ratcheted up quickly. The RPGs began tearing holes in the loose concrete or adobe walls, breaking through and starting fires. We decided it was time to leave and called for extraction. "Send the RG-33s. RG-33s are big bulletproof vehicles designed to withstand IEDs and equipped with a machine gun turret on the top. We waited, continuing the firefight and ducking the insurgents' growing spray of bullets. Finally, the relief force reported that it was 500 yards away, on the other side of the soccer field. That was as close as they were getting. A pair of army Hummers blew through the village and appeared at the doors, but they couldn't take all of us. The rest of us started to run for the RG-33s. Someone threw a smoke grenade, I guess with the thought that it would cover our retreat. All it really did was make it impossible for us to see. The grenade should be used to screen movement. You run behind the smoke. In this case, we had to run through it. We ran from the house, through the cloud of smoke, ducking bullets and dodging into the open field. It was like a scene from a movie. Bullets sprayed and plinked into the dirt. The next guy to me fell. I thought he'd been hit. I stopped, but before I could grab him, he jumped to his feet. He'd only tripped. "I'm good, I'm good," he yelled. Together, we continued toward the trucks, bullets and turf flying everywhere. Finally, we reached the trucks. I jumped into the back of one of the RG-33s. As I caught my breath, bullets splashed against one of the bulletproof windows on the side, spiderweb in the glass. Few days later, I was westward bound, back to Delta Platoon. The transfer I had asked for earlier was granted. The timing was good. Things were starting to get to me. The stress had been building. Little did I know it was going to get a lot worse, even as the fighting got a lot less. Chief Petty Officer Kyle. By now, my guys had left Al-Qaim and were at a place called Rawah, also out west near the Syrian border. Once again, they'd been put to work building barracks and the rest. I got lucky. I missed the construction work, but there wasn't much going on when I arrived, either. I was just in time for a long-range desert patrol out on the border. We drove out there for a few days, hardly seeing a person, let alone insurgents. There had been reports of smuggling across the desert, but if it was going on, it wasn't going on where we were. Meanwhile, it was hot. It was 120 degrees at least, and we were driving in Hummers that had no air conditioning. I grew up in Texas, so I know warm. This was worse,
and it was constant. You couldn't get away from it. It hardly cooled off at night. It might fall to 115. Rolling down the windows meant taking a risk if there was an IED. Almost worse was the sand, which would just blow right in and cover you. I decided I preferred the sand and IED danger to the heat. I rolled down the windows. Driving, all you saw was desert. Occasionally, there would be a nomad settlement or a tiny village. We linked up with our sister platoon. Then the next day, we stopped at a Marine base. My chief went in and did some business. A little while later, he came out and found me. "Hey," he told me, grinning. "Guess what? You just made chief." I had taken the chief's exam back in the States before we deployed. In the Navy, you usually have to take a written test to get promoted, but I'd lucked out. I got a field promotion to E5 during my second deployment and made E6 thanks to a special merit program before my third deployment. Both came without taking written tests. In both cases, I had been doing a lot of extra work within the team and had made a reputation on the battlefield. Those were important factors in awarding the new ranks. That didn't fly for the chief's exam. I took the written test and barely passed. I should explain a bit more about written tests and promotions. I'm not unusually adverse or allergic to tests, at least no more than anyone else, but the tests for SEALs added an extra burden. At the time, in order to get promoted, you had to take an exam in your job area, not as a SEAL, but in whatever area you had selected before being a SEAL. In my case, that would have meant being evaluated in the intelligence area. Obviously, I wasn't in a position to know anything about that area. I was a SEAL, not an intelligence analyst. I didn't have a clue what sort of equipment and procedures Intel used to get their jobs done. Considering the accuracy of the Intel we usually got, I would have guessed dartboard, maybe, or just a fine pair of dice. In order to get promoted, I would have had to study for the test, which would have involved going to a secure reading area, a special room where top-secret material can be reviewed. Of course, I would have had to do this in my spare time. There weren't any secure reading areas in Fallujah or Ramadi where I fought, and the literature in the latrines and heads wouldn't have cut it. The tests are now in the area of special operations and pertain to things SEALs actually do. The exams are incredibly detailed, but at least it has to do with our job. Becoming a chief was a little different. This test was on things SEALs should know. That hurdle cleared. My case had to be reviewed by a board and then go through further administrative review by the upper echelon. The board review process included all these chief petty officers and master chiefs sitting down and reviewing a package of my accomplishments. The package is supposed to be a long dossier of everything you've done as a SEAL, minus the bar fights. The only thing in my package was my service record, but that had not been updated since I graduated BUDS. My silver stars and bronze medals weren't even in there. I wasn't crazy about becoming a chief. I was happy where I was. As chief, I would have all sorts of administrative duties, and I wouldn't get as much action. Yes, it was more money for our family, but I wasn't thinking about that. Chief Primo was on the review board back at our base in the States. He was sitting next to one of the chiefs when they began reviewing my case. "Who the hell is this dipshit?" said the other chief when he saw my thin folder. "Who does he think he is?" "Why don't you and I go to lunch?" said Primo. He agreed. The other chief came back with a different attitude. "You owe me a Subway sandwich, fucker," Primo told me when I saw him later on. Then he told me the story. I owe him all that and more. The promotion came through, and, to be honest, being chief wasn't near as bad as I thought it would be. Truth is, I never cared all that much about rank. I never tried to be one of the highest-ranking guys, or even back in high school to be one of the students with the highest average. I'd do my homework in the truck in the morning. When they stuck me in the Honor Society, I made sure my grades dipped just enough the next semester to get kicked out. Then I brought them up again so my parents wouldn't get on me. Maybe the rank thing had to do with the fact that I preferred being a leader on the ground rather than an administrator in a back room. I didn't want to have to sit at a computer, plan everything, then tell everyone about it. I wanted to do my thing, which was being a sniper, get into combat, kill the enemy. I wanted to be the best at what I wanted to do. I think a lot of people had trouble with that attitude. They naturally thought that anyone who was good should have a very high rank. I guess I'd seen enough people with high rank who weren't good not to be swayed. Too much thinking. On the road again. Willie Nelson cranked through the speaker system of our Hummer as we set out for our base the next day. Music was about the only diversion we had out here, outside of the occasional stop in a village to talk to the locals. Besides the old-school country my buddy behind the wheel preferred, I listened to a bit of Toby Keith and Slipknot, country and heavy metal vying for attention. I'm a big believer in the psychological impact of music. I've seen it work on the battlefield. If you're going into combat, you want to be pumped up. You don't want to be stupid crazy, but you do want to be psyched. Music can help take the fear away. We'd listen to Papa Roach, Dope, Drowning Pool, anything that amped us up. They're all in heavy rotation on my workout mix now. But nothing could amp me up on the way back to base. It was a long, hot ride. Even though I'd just gotten some good news about my promotion, I was in a dark mood, bored on the one hand and tense on the other. Back at base, things were incredibly slow. Nothing was going on, and it started to get to me. As long as I had been in action, the idea of my being vulnerable, being mortal, had been something I could push away. There was too much going on to worry about it, or rather, I had so much else to do, I didn't really focus on it. But now, it was practically all I could think of. I had time to relax, but I couldn't. Instead, I'd lie on my bed thinking about everything I'd been through, getting shot especially. I relived the gunshot every time I lay down to rest. My heart thumped hard in my chest, probably a lot harder than it had that night in Solder City. Things seemed to go downhill in the few days after we got back from our border patrol. I couldn't sleep. I felt very jumpy, extremely jumpy, and my blood pressure shot up again, even higher than before. I felt like I was going to explode. Physically, I was beat up. 4 long combat deployments had taken their toll. My knees felt better, but my back hurt, my ankle hurt, my hearing was screwed up, my ears rang, my neck had been injured. My ribs cracked. My fingers and knuckles had been broken. I had floaters and decreased vision in my right eye. There were dozens of deep bruises and an assortment of aches and pains. I was a doctor's wet dream. But the thing that really bothered me was my blood pressure. I sweated buckets and my hands would even shake. My face, pretty white to begin with, became pale. The more I tried to relax, the worse things got. It was as if my body had started to vibrate, and thinking about it only made it buzz more. Imagine climbing a tall ladder out over a river 1,000 miles up, and there you're struck by lightning. Your body becomes electric, but you're still alive. In fact, you're not only aware of everything that's happening, but you know you can deal with it. You know what you have to do to get down. So you do. You climb down. But when you're back on the ground, the electricity won't go away. You try to find a way to discharge the electricity, to ground yourself. But you can't find the damn lightning rod to take the electricity away. Unable to eat or sleep, I finally went to the docs and told them to check me out. They took a look at me and asked if I wanted medication. Not really, I told them, but I did take the meds. They also suggested that since the mission tempo was practically non-existent and we were only a few weeks from going home anyway, it made sense for me to go home. Not knowing what else to do, I agreed. 14. Home and out. Ducking out. It was late August when I left. As usual, it was almost surreal. One day I was in the war, the next I was home. I felt bad about leaving. I didn't want to tell anyone about the blood pressure or anything else. I kept it to myself as best I could. To be honest, it felt a little like I was ducking out on my boys, running away because my heart was pounding funny or whatever the hell it was doing. Nothing that I had accomplished earlier could erase the feeling that I was letting my boys down. I know it doesn't make sense. I know I had accomplished a huge amount. I needed a rest, but I felt I shouldn't take one. I thought I should be stronger than was possible. To top things off, some of the medication apparently didn't agree with me. Trying to help me sleep, a doctor back home in San Diego prescribed a sleeping pill. It put me out, so much so that when I really woke up, I was on base with no recollection of working out at home and driving myself to base. Taya told me about my workout, and I knew I had driven to work because my truck was there. I never took that one again. It was nasty. Taya. It's taken me years to get my head around some of this stuff. On the surface, Chris wants to just go and have a good time. When people really need him, though, when lives are on the line, he is the most dependable guy. He's got a situational sense of responsibility and caring. I saw this in his promotions in the military. He didn't care. He didn't want the responsibility of the higher rank, even though it would mean providing better for his family. And yet if a job needed to be done, he was there. He will always rise to the challenge, and he's prepared because he's been thinking about it. It was a real dichotomy, and I don't even think a lot of people understood it. It was even hard for me to reconcile at times. Protecting people. While I was home, I got involved in a fairly interesting scientific program relating to stress and combat situations. It used virtual reality to test what sorts of effects battle has on your body. In my case, specifically, they monitored my blood pressure, or at least that was the one measurement that really interested me. I wore a headpiece and special gloves while viewing a simulation. It was basically a video game, but it was still pretty cool. Well, in the simulations, my blood pressure and heart rate would start out steady. Then, once we got into a firefight, they would drop. I would just sit there and do everything I had to do, real comfortable. As soon as it was over and things were peaceful, my heart rate would just zoom. Interesting. The scientists and doctors running the experiment believe that during the heat of the battle, my training would take over and would somehow relax me. They were really intrigued because apparently they hadn't seen that before. Of course, I'd lived it every day in Iraq. There was one simulation that left a deep impression on me. In this one, a Marine was shot, and he went down screaming. He'd been gut shot. As I watched that scene, my blood pressure spiked even higher than it had been. I didn't need a scientist or a doctor to tell me what that was about. I could just about feel that kid dying on my chest in Fallujah again. People tell me I saved hundreds and hundreds of people, but I have to tell you, it's not the people you saved that you remember. It's the ones you couldn't save. Those are the ones you talk about. Those are the faces and situations that stay with you forever. In or out? My enlistment was coming to an end. The Navy kept trying to entice me to stay, making different offers. Handle training, work in England, anything I wanted just so I would stay in the Navy. Even though I had told Taya I wouldn't reenlist, I wasn't ready to quit. I wanted to go back to the war. I felt I'd been cheated on my last deployment. I struggled trying to decide what to do. Some days I was through with the Navy, other days I was ready to tell my wife the hell with it and reenlist. We talked about it a lot. Taya. I told Chris that both our kids needed him, especially at that particular time, our son. If he wasn't going to be there, then I would move closer to my father so at least he would grow up with a strong grandfather very close to him. I didn't want to do that at all. And Chris really loved us all. He really wanted to have and nurture a strong family. Part of it came down to the conflict we'd always had. Where were our priorities? God, family, country, my version, or God, country, family, Chris's? To my mind, Chris had already given his country so much, a tremendous amount. The previous 10 years had been filled with constant war.
Heavy combat deployments were combined with extensive training workups that kept him away from home. It was more heavy action and absence than any other SEAL I knew of. It was time to give his family some of himself. But, as always, I couldn't make the decision for him. The Navy suggested that they could send me to Texas as a recruiter. That sounded pretty good, since the job would allow me to have regular hours and come home at night. It looked to me like a possible compromise. "You have to give me a little time to work this out," said the Master Chief I was dealing with. "This isn't the sort of thing we can do overnight." I agreed to extend my enlistment a month while he worked on it. I waited and waited. No orders came. "It's coming, it's coming," he said. "You have to extend again." So I did. A few more weeks passed. We were almost through October by now, and no orders came through. So I called him up and asked what the hell was going on. "It's a catch-22, he explained. "They want to give it to you, but it's a 3-year billet. You don't have any time." In other words, they wanted me to enlist first. Then they would give me the job. But there were no guarantees, no contract. I'd been there before. I finally told them, "Thanks, but no thanks. I'm getting out." Taya. "He always says, I feel like a quitter. I think he's done his job, but I know that's how he feels. He thinks if there are people out there fighting, it should be him. And a lot of other SEALs feel that way about themselves as well, but I believe not one of them would blame him for getting out." Ryan gets married. Ryan and I remained close after he returned to the States. In fact, our friendship grew even stronger, which I wouldn't have thought possible. I felt drawn to him by his tremendous spirit. He'd been a warrior in combat. Now he was an even greater warrior in life. You never completely forgot that he was blind, but you also never ever got the impression that his disability defined him. He had to get a prosthetic eye made because of his wounds. According to LT, who went with him to pick it up, he actually had two. One was a regular eye, and the other had a golden seal trident where the iris ordinarily would be. Once a SEAL, always a SEAL. I'd been with Ryan a lot before he got hurt. A lot of the guys on the team had a wicked sense of humor, but Ryan was in a class by himself. He'd get you in stitches. He wasn't any different after he got shot. He just had a very dry sense of humor. One day a young girl came up to him, looked at his face, and asked, "What happened to you?" He bent down and said in a very serious voice, "Never run with scissors." Dry, droll, and a heart of gold. You couldn't help but love him. We were all prepared to hate his girlfriend. We were sure she'd leave him after he was torn up, but she stood by him. He finally proposed, and we were all happy about it. She is one awesome lady. If there is a poster child for overcoming disabilities, Ryan was it. After the injury, he went to college, graduated with honors, and had an excellent job waiting for him. He climbed Mount Hood, Mount Rainier, and a bunch of other mountains. He went hunting and shot a prize trophy elk with the help of a spotter and a gun with some badass technology. He competed in a triathlon. I remember one night Ryan said that he was glad it was he who got shot instead of any of the other guys. Sure, he was angry at first, but he felt he was at peace and living a full life. He felt he could handle it and be happy no matter what. He was right. When I think about the patriotism that drives SEALs, I am reminded of Ryan recovering in a hospital in Bethesda, Maryland. There he was, freshly wounded, almost fatally, and blind for life. Many reconstructive surgeries to his face loomed ahead. You know what he asked for? He asked for someone to wheel him to a flag and give him some time. He sat in his wheelchair for close to a half hour, saluting as the American flag whipped in the wind. That's Ryan, a true patriot. A genuine warrior with a heart of gold. Of course, we all gave him shit and told him somebody probably wheeled him in front of a dumpster and just told him it was a flag. Being Ryan, he dished out as many blind jokes as he took and had us all rolling every time we talked.
When he moved away, we would chat on the phone and get together whenever we could. In 2010, I found out he and his wife were expecting their first child. Meanwhile, the injuries he'd had in Iraq required further surgeries. He went into the hospital one morning. Later that afternoon, I got a call from Marcus Luttrell asking if I had heard about Ryan. "Yeah, I just talked to him yesterday," I told him. "He and his wife are having a baby. Isn't it great?"
"He died just a little while ago," said Marcus, his voice quiet.
Something had gone wrong at the hospital.
It was a tragic end to a heroic life. I'm not sure any of us who knew him have gotten over it. I don't think I ever will. The baby was a beautiful girl. I'm sure her father's spirit lives on in her.
Mighty Warriors. After her son's death, Mark Lee's mom, Debbie, became almost a surrogate mother to the other members of our platoon. A very courageous woman, she has dedicated herself to helping other warriors as they have made the transition from the battlefield. She's now president of America's Mighty Warriors, www.americasmightywarriors.org, and has done a lot personally for veterans through what she calls random acts of kindness, inspired by Mark's life and a letter he wrote to her before he passed away. There's nothing random about Debbie. She's a dedicated and hard-working woman, as devoted to her cause as Mark was to his. Before he died, Mark wrote an incredible letter home. Available at the site, it told a moving story about some of the things he saw in Iraq, a terrible hospital, ignorant and despicable people. But it was also an extremely positive letter, full of hope and encouraging all of us to do some small part for others. To my mind, though, whatever he wrote home doesn't adequately describe the Mark we all knew. There was a lot more to him. He was a real tough guy with a great sense of humor. He was a gung-ho warrior and a great friend. He had unshakable faith in God and loved his wife with might. Heaven is surely a better place because he's there, but Earth has lost one of its best. Craft. Deciding to leave the Navy was hard enough, but now I was going to be out of a job. It was time to figure out what to do with the rest of my life. I had a number of options and possibilities. I'd been talking with a friend of mine named Mark Spicer about starting a sniper school in the States. After 25 years in the British Army, Mark retired as a sergeant major. He was one of the foremost snipers in their army, and had served over 20 years as a sniper and sniper platoon commander. Mark has written 3 books on sniping and is one of the world's leading experts on the subject. We both realized there was and is a need for certain types of very specific training for military and police units. No one was providing the sort of hands-on instruction that would help prepare their personnel for the different situations they might find. With our experience, we knew we could tailor courses and provide enough range time to make a difference. The problem was getting everything together to do it. Money, of course, was a pretty big consideration. Then, partly by chance, I happened to meet someone who realized the company could be a good investment and who also had faith in me, J. Kyle Bass. Kyle had made a lot of money investing, and when we met, he was looking for a bodyguard. I guess he figured, who better than a SEAL? But when we got talking and he asked where I saw myself in a few years, I told him about the school. He was intrigued, and rather than hiring me as his bodyguard, he helped provide the financing for our company. And just like that, Craft International was born. Actually, it wasn't just like that. We busted butt to get it going, working long hours and sweating out all the details the way any entrepreneurs do. 2 other guys joined Mark and me to form the ownership team, Beau French and Stephen Young. Their areas of expertise have more to do with the business side of things, but they're both knowledgeable about weapons and the tactics that we teach. Today, Craft International's corporate offices are in Texas. We have training sites in Texas and Arizona and work internationally on security measures and other special projects. Mark can occasionally be seen on the History Channel. He's pretty comfortable in front of the cameras, so at times he'll relax into a real thick British accent.
The History Channel is kind enough to translate his thick accent into good old boy English with subtitles. We have yet to need subtitles for any craft courses, but we haven't